So, probably what I'm going to talk about might be a bit different from what you expect I'm going to talk about. But anyway, as you open up the newspaper, this is probably what you're going to see, or else if you look at the TV, what you're going to see is the fact that there's global warming happening. And then, if you turn the pages in the newspaper, what you're probably then going to see is, well, you're going to see animal production systems. And that they're being contributors for, well, depending on the country, the main contributors for greenhouse gas emissions. So animal agriculture is, on average, comes from 18% of greenhouse gas emissions. And these are the types of pictures that you see. So then when you turn the page again, then you see that food security is becoming an issue. So I guess what we have to do as animal scientists or agriculturalists is to figure out how do we actually square this circle and be able to feed the growing food or the growing population while at the same time without increasing the environmental footprint associated with it. So there's a huge amount of work going on in methane emissions and individual feed intake and feed efficiency, and I have actually done a lot of the work too, but I would ask, is this actually the solution? And there are more than one way to get at that. It is a part of the solution, but it's not the only solution. And if I was industry, it's not where I would put my money. I wouldn't put my money on feed intake, and I wouldn't put my money on methane emissions, unless I had the basics actually already corrected and in place. And that's really what I'm going to focus on my talk on, is the basics. This is what we would always have called the higher level or the honors paper. What I'm going to talk about is the lower level of the tax paper. Get that right first. And this came up, I think, either today or yesterday. It's all really about systems efficiency. And we can define systems efficiency in a number of different ways, depending on how complicated you want the data to be. But to me, this is one of the easiest ways to define it. Herd feed efficiency, it's a function of the weight of the offspring at slaughter, or you could say the value of the offspring at order at slaughter, and multiplied by the weaning rate less the amount of animals or the amount of those weanings that die. And so that's your output. And then your input system, or input components, is the number of cows that we have, by how much each cow eats over its lifetime, plus the weaning rate by how much each of the offspring eats during its lifetime. So essentially what you're looking for is you're looking for a low maintenance, high fertility, good longevity cow with lots of milk to feed a fast growing calf. And in other words, what people would say is, on average, you're looking for a small cow with a virtual size of a bucket. So if you can put a good terminal sire onto this good maternal cow, and the calf will grow fast, but also the cow has sufficient milk to feed that animal. So from an environmental perspective, we can just modify this really slightly, just changing a few different levels. So we can change it to the herd, environmental efficiency, and rather than having dry matter intake, we can change it to environmental cost of the cow and the environmental cost of the offspring. I think it's probably important that we set the record straight as well. Agriculture, animal agriculture, is getting a bad perception that an increasing number that it is having huge implications for greenhouse gas emissions. But if you look at some of the work that Judy Caper has done, and I just picked out the US scenario here, and you compare beef production from 1997 to 2007, you can see that there's a reduction of around 16% in carbon dioxide equivalents. Because methane emissions and carbon dioxide, they have each different potential polluting powers, things are generally brought to a common standard, which is carbon dioxide equivalents. As I said earlier this morning, I'm predominantly a dairy geneticist. What we have achieved actually something similar. You can see it's a narrower increase, but of course it's over a longer time period. So pretty much similar. So we are actually achieving greater or reduced environmental footprint of our products. And during that time period, of course, there was no mention of methane emissions, emission of animals, and there was very little mention of feed intake or residual feed intake for that kind of being mentioned in these animals. So we're achieving this using simple approaches. This is how you can summarize an animal breeding program. As you can see, it's kind of a different process. Of course, my nutritional and physiology colleagues will tell us that this is because geneticists don't really have a clue what they're doing, they're going around in circles the whole time. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through each of these individual components individually and really focus on their environmental implications. So if we start off with our goal, what's our goal of our breeding program? And probably what most people would say is it's profit, or farm profit. Or put in words, it's to improve the genetic ability of an animal's progeny to generate farm profitability. That was the goal of old. And maybe if we did have this goal, but this is the goal of new, is that we have to now include that we must do so in an environmentally and socially responsible manner. So by socially responsible, I mean animal welfare as well. Also, from a goal perspective, remember as animal breeders, we're thinking long term. We're thinking of animals that are going to be producing, or their grandparents, or grandparents are going to be producing in 7 to 10 years' time. So even though we might be taxed on methane emissions now, we need to know what's going to happen in 10 years' time. What are the policy implications that are going to be enforced? Especially with the likes of high water protocol being enforced. If we're not meeting our targets, there's going to be penalties. Somebody has to pick up those penalties. So we need to think about what is the future going to hold and include that into our breeding goals. The second part of it is to state the breeding objective, also commonly called the breeding goal. It's a list of traits which are optimally weighted to the best describe the goal of head-up breeding decision alluded. So from a beef perspective, and also from a dairy perspective, or actually any animal perspective, it's made up of two components: revenue-generating traits, which in this scenario would be carcass yield and value, simplicity, and simply put, and then the cost of reproduction traits. So here would be feed intake, reproduction, and longevity. And again, we must be futuristic thinking. We can't say that we're only going to include the traits that have a current market value, but what are the traits that are likely going to have and then I would ask, well, what environmental traits? Included into a breeding objective, it must fulfill three criteria. Firstly, it must be important. And traditionally, we would have said it must be economically important. But as I said at the first few slides, that's now changing. Is it environmentally important or is it socially important? And we talked about how we weigh these factors later on. Secondly, it must exhibit genetic variation. We can't change something through breeding unless there's genetic variation. But I have yet, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I have yet to find one trait that is not genetic. And thirdly, it should be measurable. Ideally, it should be measurable at a low cost. Or it should be correlated with a trait which has genetic variation and is also measurable. Again, ideally at a low cost and also preferably at a young age. So, when we put together breeding goals that I've recently started in horses and I've put together the breeding objective, we know we can't measure that. Oh, we can't measure that either. And that's too expensive to measure. What I would say in this scenario is you don't think about that. First of all, you list the traits that are important, and it could be methane emissions. And then later, when you do the economic analysis, if there is no cost benefit of actually measuring those traits, then you can discard it in your breeding objective. So how do we put these weightings? And this is definitely the most contentious issue in animal breeding: is how much do you weight the individual traits within a breeding objective? We do in Ireland. These are really good for performance traits because the economic value of the trait is the value it incurs or the cost it incurs holding everything else constant. So the economic value of carcass weight, this is going to be in your breeding objective as well, the economic value of carcass weight is the price per pound per kilo of carcass weight. Very, very simple. The economic value of feed intake is the cost of 1 kilogram of feed. However, when you start talking about these kind of, as I call them, fuddy-duddy traits like environment, what is the weighted evidence of these? They currently have no monetary value. And there are ways that we can do this. There's choice experiments or willingness to pay experiments. And one example is the cows and mice, which is used by surgeons to determine when they get a kind of a heart transplant or a heart transplant, who should get an actual transplant. So they ask, do you value work more than your family? And then the next question is, do you value your family more than your dog? And from this, they can actually determine how much weight you put on each of these priorities. So in this scenario, we would say, well, what would you prefer more? Increasing protein or increasing the meat quality or for human health or reducing methane emissions? You might answer methane emissions. And they say, well, would you like to reduce methane emissions by 10 kilos or increase polyunsaturated passage? Polyunsaturated fatty acids by such a degree. And by iterating on that, it's a bit of like a Delphi study, you can actually come up with weighted factors. The other approach, which is used by a number of countries in dairy, is to do what's called the desired gains approach, where you decide a priori that you want to improve, say, carcass yield by 1%, improve fertility by 0.5%, improve health by 0.25%. And you can actually back calculate it, the weighting factors, if they are all possible to be achieved. So these are really good for environmental threats. There's no monetary value for methane, but if you tell me that we want to improve methane emissions by 1% per year, then we can back calculate what emphasis we should put on the green effect. There was a lot of talk yesterday about national indices. We have two national indices. We have a terminal index and we have a maternal index. I'm talking about green here. And this just shows you the relative emphasis that we have on different components within our terminal index. You can see it's around 50-50. Half of it revenue generating traits, predominantly, you can see characters on it. Character pattern confirmation, and then you have the input traits, which are feed intake constituting around 20% of the emphasis, and facility or direct capacity constituting around 20% of the emphasis. We look at our maternal index, we're seeing that fertility and survival is accounting for around 20% of the emphasis, terminal ability is also still accounting for around 20% of the emphasis, and feed intake and recovery is accounting for around 22-23% of the emphasis. So again, it's a combination of both the output and the input traits. And you might wonder, why do we have terminal traits within a maternal index? That's because, of course, half of the genes of a steer or a heifer come from the cattle. If we didn't have them, you'd have jerseys of the top of the maternal list for the beef herd, because we need to include some terminal components as well. So what do we try to do with this, and where does it all come back into the environmental impact? What I'm showing you here is the just these are a list of AI bulls that we have available in Ireland. Here is genetic merit for carcass weight. It's adjusted through common age, so essentially this is genetic merit for bush. And on the vertical axis, we have genetic merit for feed intake. Only looking at these two traits. You can see there's a little bit of clustering going on, and that's because we evaluate all breeds together on a common base. So these ones might be young, actually I say they're the youngest, they eat a bit more than they expected on a lower carcass weight. Here might be some of the terminal breeds. But if I superimpose on top of that now the ranking of these animals are our terminal index, you can see the blue are low index animals, the red are average index animals, and the green are high index animals. Now if you actually look at that, there is a trend. What the index is doing is simultaneously improving growth rate here, but also at the same time reducing the index. And that brings us back to my original equation. What we're doing is we're increasing our numerator and we're reducing our denominator. So we're achieving gains in performance twice as fast. And if you think about it, what we're doing is with greater growth rate, we're reducing the number of days to slaughter, so we're reducing the number of days the animal is eating. But also at the same time, we're reducing the amount of feed the animal is eating per day. So again, it's a double whammy. And the implications that this has for the environment. So then you'd ask, well, can we actually make gains in a lot of these traits? I'm just going to go through some of these traits. Some are good and some are bad. So here I'm showing some of the terminal traits in Ireland. These are our genetic trends across all the breeds. The red here is carcass weight, which essentially is growth weight and it's adjusted for accommodation. We're increasing muscularity and we're also increasing animal size. However, we know that there's a negative correlation or an unfavorable correlation between terminal traits and maternal traits. And if you look at the genetic trends for our maternal traits, you can see that they're not very, very good. Maternal weaning weight, so in other words, milk in the beef cow, is declining year on year. Age of first calving is increasing, so age of mature or age of puberty or our maturing rate is getting worse year on year, and calving interval of fertility is getting worse year on year. So these are the implications, and you can see a lot of the time now, if you look at the genetic trends for the different breeds, direct weaning weight genetic merit is increasing, but maternal weaning weight is declining. So in other words, we're putting more and more good growth genes into these animals, but we're taking away the milk genes from the cow, so the cow does not have sufficient milk to feed the good genes of that growing animal. And there are now some cows, apparently pedigree cows, being born that don't have sufficient colostrum to feed their calves. So this is not good efficiency. This is good efficiency and this is starting to deteriorate this. Having come from the dairy world, I've seen this. The last 20 to 30 years, we select for milk production like this. We achieve massive gains, but to the detriment of fertility. And if you actually do an economic analysis, you will see that dairy farmers made no money. They increased their revenues, but they also proportionally increased their costs at the same rate, resulting in no change in profits in the way. So again, this is exactly the same thing here. What we're doing is, yes, we're improving the numerator, the top line, but we're also disimproving the denominator, and it's eroding those improvements that we're seeing in the numerator. And the result is no impact on the environment or no impact even in profit. Irish farmers are losing money. It's a subsidy by people in business. And people would argue to me, and same in fertility, or same in dairy, they'll say, ah, fertility, they talk about this heritability, we can talk about that in a second, but they say the heritability of fertility is too low, you can't improve it. Well, this shows quite the opposite. If we can disimprove something using genetics, then we can improve it using genetics. And just to give you an example, going to the dairy world, the red here is halving into our fertility that we have seen in Irish dairy herd for the past few decades. So worse, the higher number is worse. Blue is the genetic herd for these animals, exactly the same animals we're calving for over that same time period. I take full credit here, of course, because this is a nice article of work for my organization, but you can see that the trend started to improve, the genetic merit for the animals, the fertility started to improve, and was followed by on-the-ground improvements on farms for fertility. So if we actually extrapolate that further, the last 4 years, linearly extrapolated, by the year 2020, our fertility level in dairy in Ireland will be back to where we were in 1989. Yet, we have seen a 60% increase in milk solids during that period. And you might say, that's bad, what has that got to do with the environment? Well, that has huge implications for the environmental footprint of the system as a whole. And UK data would show that if you were to improve in dairy, the fertility levels from 2003 to 1995 levels, you can reduce methane emissions nationally by 11% and reduce ammonia emissions by 9%. So that was bringing it down to 1995 levels, which were also suboptimal. If you brought it down to optimal fertility levels, you can reduce your methane and ammonia emissions by 40%. Still, we never talked about feed intake, we never talked about methane emissions. We were able to achieve this using the low-hanging fruit. So then you might ask, because in a good breeding structure, you would say, well, if we have all of these tools in place, we want to go to the next level. The next level is these environmental. And we talk a lot about methane, but we forget a lot about nitrogen and heat. And agriculture is hugely responsible for nitrogen pollution and phosphorus pollution. But if I was a betting man, this is where I would bet on water. Nobody's really talking about water efficiency. Everybody talks about the increase in food demand of 70% by the year 2050. 2050 is 36 years away. By the year 2025, 64% of the world's population is going to live in a water-stressed area. Agriculture, animal agriculture, is using 8% of human water use, and it uses 70% of groundwater use. There is going to be huge pressure, if not already, and we've seen it in the likes of dairy in California, there's going to be huge pressure on water use efficiency. And I'm not now advocating that we all go out and measure water use efficiency, but if we have good fertility rates in our herds, good growth rates so that the animals have finished a lot faster, they are going to consume a lot less over their lifetime and the whole system as a whole. Well, let's go back to the sexy science of going out there measuring methane and spending loads of money. I would ask, a lot of people show genetic variation in methane emissions. However, I have absolutely no interest in that trend. I have interest in what I call residual methane production, and I'll talk about that in a second. Also, a lot of people talk about methane emissions per unit of intake, and they show genetic variation in this. I'm going to change your mind about what that about that trait, and hopefully next time you see that being presented, you can challenge those people as to what are they actually doing. But anyway, if we look at residual methane production, on average, animals that grow faster and eat a lot more produce a lot of methane. So that means that, yes, I can reduce methane emissions tomorrow by getting small little runs that we slaughter at a very young age and eat absolutely nothing. However, they're not going to leave any profit. So those of you that are familiar with residual feed intake, it's the same concept. What I would do is I would address daily methane emissions on growth, maintenance, and intake. And it's how much variation at this point is actually left if that is the exploitable methane emissions. I can guarantee you it's pretty small. That's exactly the same with residual feed intake. A lot of people talk about the heritability of residual feed intake, but the variation, we talk about it in a second, the variation, I would argue, is actually more important. And the variation is smaller. That was meat definition, but what about nitrogen use efficiency? Adjusting nitrogen levels for growth, meat maintenance, and intake. And we can also talk about residual meat, or residual water intake, which is how much water does an animal drink over and above what you expect it to drink based on its growth potential maintenance on the feed. So just to go on to this ratio trait, as I said, a lot of people talk about this methane intensity, and they say that it's heritable, so therefore we can actually improve it. It's hard to figure it out because they don't present enough information for me to actually do the calculations, but I would question if some of this heritability is actually just picking up our genetic variation in the denominator. I'll just give you an example. I took my own PhD student's data, John Crowley. He published a lot of work on feed efficiency using performance test codes from over 2,500 performance test codes at our performance test station in Ireland. I randomly simulated daily methane emissions of these animals. So that can be a heritability of zero because it's random. John showed in his thesis that the heritability of granular intake in that data was 49%. So what I did was I took my random methane emissions and I divided them by the actual feed intake of all of those animals. And lo and behold, I got a heritability of 19%, which coincidentally is exactly the same heritability that's been published in literature in sheep. It's not really what's been published in cattle. So you can see absolutely no genetic variation in methane emissions can still get you a nice heritability for methane intensity. So you need to be very, very careful about the statistics that we're actually using. And that brings me on to my next point, heritability. I think this is probably the most misunderstood or misused statistic in quantitative genetics. Now, it's really well known that quantitative geneticists, they love statistics and equations, and it's kind of an unwritten rule that when you're giving a talk on quantitative genetics, you have to look at these 20 equations. So this is my equation, and I'm sure most people are familiar with it. It says that genetic gain is a function of intensity of selection, the accuracy of selection, the genetic variation that's present, and the generation interval, which is the average age of the parents who are quantitative. So the accuracy of genetic evaluation, so how accurately can we identify the good growing animals from the poor growing animals, is a function of the heritability, but also the information content. And the two of them actually work with each other. So you can overcome low heritability by having high information content. But I would argue in the genomics era, and we don't have enough time to go through the details, but in the genomics era, heritability is close to irrelevant, except for novel traits. And because I'll show you the example, so if we have a heritability of 100%, there might be the perception out there that we can make massive genetic growth in that trait. But if that's 100, if that's a million, if that's some tiny number, if that one is zero, everything else is zero. So if you have tiny genetic variation, it doesn't matter what your heritability is, you're not going to make rapid genetic progress. But what it also means is that if you have a low heritability, if you have lots of information, you can still get accuracies at one. And as long as you have sufficient genetic variation, then you can achieve genetic gains. So that's why I go back to my equation here. And I don't want to know what the genetic variation of this trait is, because I want to know what the genetic variation of this trait is, because it's independent of the individual energy sense. So that brings me on to the selection criteria. We're going to speed up a little bit because I'm going to be as slow as this. The selection criteria tells us what are the measurable traits that we have that can predict our breeding objective very, very well. So if we say that our breeding objective is growth, fertility, the environment, dry matter intake, and common food optimal traits. Our criterion, it could be live weight or calf intake. So what we're doing here is we're predicting growth using animal live weight, and we're predicting fertility using calf intake. So the difference between two consecutive calf intakes is calf interval. And that's actually the trait that we use in Ireland for our fertility evaluation. So it begs the question, well, then what traits do we measure to measure the environment and the effect and the dry matter intake effect? Do we all need to go out there and buy all these feed intake systems and put them and measure lots of animals to measure dry matter intake? We need to start filling calorie-free such, I know it's like part of the minute, to do two or three of them, spending lots of money to measure defect. I don't have the answer, but I think we need to look at alternatives. And this is what we're actually doing in Ireland. We are in dairy, we're not really going to measure by manure effect. We're going to use our common sense to try and predict what by manure effect is. When people talk about measuring methane emissions, I'm sure those of you that are involved in it, immediately think of calorie release. And there are other methods available. This is called the sulfur-chlorohexide 6 method, or the SF6 method. And a lot of the experts, the nutritionists and people working methane, would say that's not good enough. It's not measuring it very accurately. This is the only way that you can measure methane emissions. However, I would question that, of course. I think if those of us that are producers would know that if you put these animals from their natural grazing environment into a box, they're going to react very, very differently. Much like if you put an Irishman into a pub, he's going to react very, very differently from what they want on the side. So what I would actually argue, even though these hens are intrinsic problems, I think these are still going to be better measurements. And just to give you an example, I don't have the data from the US, but we've done this in Ireland, where we have the carcass grading system, the Euro carcass grading system. The correlation between the Euro carcass grading system and actual saleable meat used for practices. Yet I don't see anybody jumping up and down about this. But if I suggest doing something like this, or trying to measure feed intake using climate people, people would go crazy. And I can guarantee you the correlation is a lot greater than 5.3. So I would ask, well, do we even need to go out and measure these methane emissions at the moment, unless we have the basics right? And this is just to give an example. We can use what's called selection index theory in the genetics to predict genetic variable trait from our predictor traits. And I'm just showing you here, if we want to predict dry matter intake, we can get a very good prediction of dry matter intake using average daily gain, live weight, the fat level of the animal, and the muscular level of the animal. And this is from a meta-analysis of 20 studies. If you do the calculations of this, you can actually scale on 90% of the genetic variables in feed intake using these traits. I never measured feed intake. Everybody here, I'm sure, is measuring growth. If you're measuring growth, you have to measure live weight. It's pretty easy to run a multi-family process of an animal. And live development here was actually subjectively scored by people that look at that. So for the cost of close to nothing, I can explain around 90% of the genetic variation in feed intake. And I would argue, is it really worth going after the remaining 10%? If you have everything else, sorted, yes, but I'm good. You could go after the remaining 10%. But also I would say, well, is daily feed intake really that important? So I would say that I'm actually expecting a lot more of this if I account for days on feed as well, because days on feed is driven actually by average daily gain. It's the feed intake of the animal over its entire life track, from birth until slaughter. And average daily gain, or number of days on feed, is also a component of that. Well, this is pretty simple, 90% of genetic variance. What we're looking at now, especially in dairy, is, and I'm sure you can appreciate this, if the cow is not at speed bump, it's not eating. So we have, and we already have RFIDs on a lot of our cows, we put a transponder at the feed bump, we can count how long the animal is at the feed bump. I know, and you'd be right to say that there's differences in biting rate and differences in muscle size and whatever differences in bite size, but I'm sure I can knock off another 3-4% of units off. If you do it like infrared tomography, we know that heat accounts for a large proportion of differences in feed efficiency. If we use infrared tomography to measure the heat of, say, the eyes of the hoofs, not only are we measuring lameness and potentially water health and potentially cows coming out of estrus, we're also probably getting a very good predictor of feed intake, or a residual component that people call residual feed intake. So we can probably chip away at another 5-6% of units of this, which leads us to around 94% prediction accuracy. I can guarantee you, your live weights probably aren't going to be predicted. You can maybe, if you're weighing your animals because of blood, you're not thinking about anywhere near. But after you're talking to methane emissions, and all of you are in good fitness to say that you shouldn't be, or you shouldn't be wasting money measuring after methane emissions per cow, I think we probably should in the research phase because we don't know what these correlations are. That equation that I showed you with residual methane production, we don't know what it is. It could be phenomenal, I could be totally wrong. It could be phenomenal if we massively increase GDP, or it could be absolutely fine. And there and then we say, no,
he said that we're going to drive the environmental footprint to capital.
So we don't really know what this is. We can't, I can't really type it, how much it will take for it. Well, actually, I have done some dairy and from 80% using wood production and libraries and body weight change. That's using flexible weight. So we need to know what these parameters are. So that brings us on to the breeding scheme design. This one, you can talk about this for days, because it includes genetic and genomic evaluation. I'm going to go through it pretty sharp. The three components really, of course, is genetic evaluations. We've heard a lot about that. The second one is genomic evaluations. We've heard even more about that. And then the third one is breeding scheme design or selection pathways. So I just want to make one point, and a pretty controversial point that's very popular, is that I'm really, really glad we didn't have genomic selection paper here, especially in dairy, because we didn't have everything up here at the very start right for us. We had a rubbish grain complex. It consisted of only milk production. Milk and dairy is antagonistically correlated with fertility. So what we did was we improved our position to suboptimal levels. If we had genomics, we now had infertile animals because we've driven so fast. So I would say the same thing to you guys as bee farmers. I've shown you the genetic trends. You can read the papers. There is an antagonistic genetic correlation between terminal traits and the terminal traits. So as you, if you don't have a breeding objective, which includes maternal and terminal traits, what you're going to end up in a few years' time is exactly the same as dairy. And you know what? You're going to do it a lot faster if you have genetics, because you're going to increase the rate of genetic gain by at least 50%. So you must have the database. You must have good genetic evaluation. A lot of people are talking about genomics now. Genomics are driven from genetic evaluation. If the genetic evaluation is wrong, the genomics are also wrong. You must have a well-structured breeding program. And, of course, we could have all the best genes in the world, but we know in beef there's less AI use than in dairy. So we need to actually get farmers, firstly, to use genetic evaluation, and secondly, to use AI to get it. And then finally, of course, geneticists are known for their arrogance, but I'm not arrogant enough to say that management also doesn't have an impact. We need to be able to manage these animals accordingly. But you've seen this slide, and how many times gets on this slide for me today, you still need field types. Genomics is not going to overcome, for a short, medium term anyway, the necessity that there is for field types. And going back again to this equation, this is the key. We want accurate genetic evaluation. And then to do that, we're still going to need field types and genomic information. That will increase our genetic gain, and as long as we have an appropriate breeding objective, we will improve genetic gain for profitability and for environmental. Just to finish up on the dissemination system, as I said earlier, you can have all the best genetics in the world, but if you don't have a method to efficiently and effectively get it out into the commercial herd, then we're going to be arguably, AI is the best, but of course, because for social demographic reasons, in Ireland in particular, here, I guess, really from a production system perspective in the rangelands, you can't just use AI. It has to be naturally controlled. And I've given props to the EU AI companies where I put up two zones and I put AI stations on it. Because it could, genomics could actually be the best of AI stations. And it all depends on what they do to actually react to this. Because what is an AI bull? An AI bull is just a natural mating bull that is picked up as a cat. It costs, in Ireland, it costs over 11,000 euros, so $15,000 to progeny test an animal. That will cost around $30 to progeny test an animal. And there are a group of farmers now who have set up their own cooperative, small group of farmers, but genetic AB farmers who have set up their cooperative to genomically test all their calves, find the best 20, send them to an AI station to extract DNA, and they now have straws to fill our own group at $2 for $3. And they use the other one. I get a lot of trouble with my boss when he says, when we're in the department meeting, and he says, what area are we missing of research? Social science is an issue, an area that we're really, really missing. We got all the best science and genomics and tools and EPDs and selection indexes in the world, but if you don't understand why the producers are using them, then you're really going to. Just to give you an example of some of the potential genetics, and we're always doing this. We set up selection experiments, but we also present this on a continuous basis. This is data from our performance test herd, where we have animals. And again, this came up yesterday, comparing the top 20% of our animals in the genetic merit for our terminal index versus the bottom 20%. So you can see the differences in index.
our indexes are property-based, and I fully believe indexes, or rating indexes, should be property-based, because you can classify money, you can't classify standard deviation.
So if you look at the differences, the difference there around 50 euros between the EPD, so that's probably around 100 euros, or 120, 130 euros in euros in actual rating value. These are the elements when they came into the performance test, you can see there wasn't that much difference between actual life rates at the start. If you look at it at the end, there's actually a larger difference. The lower genetic variable animals were actually about 14, 15 kilograms heavier than the higher genetic variable animals. And you look at their average daily gain, you can see that the lower genetic variable animals were going faster. So at this stage, I was starting to sweat a lot because the lower genetic variable animals were actually a little bit outperforming the higher genetic variable animals. But if we look at the rest of it, we can look at the dry matter intake of these animals. We can see that they were eating 1.4, so almost 1.5 kilos less per day. They were slaughtered 0.6 of a month, so more than half a month earlier. And actually, although they were growing a lot of live weight, they weren't actually growing a lot of carcass. So you can see the kilo differences. So rather than here, they were 15 kilograms heavier, they were actually here, they were 9 kilograms carcass weight lighter. And if we actually look at meat cuts, then you can see that there was around 36 or 37 kilograms difference in high-value meat cuts that were available. So it was delivering a profit. It was delivering it through not only earlier or lower dry matter intake per day, but also less time or less number of days per feed. In feeding for 15 days less, they multiply that by around 10 kilograms, you can see that 150 kilograms less feed. And you can do the maths yourself. So is there an environmental benefit? Of course there's an environmental benefit, but they're eating less and therefore producing less methane, and also they're eating less per day, but also they're eating less for a number of days. And this is huge environmental cost. So just to finish off with the economic analysis, and again when we start talking about the economic analysis and the profit, who's the profit for? The profit for the seed stock producers, the profit for the farmers, is the profit for the EI station, is the profit for the country, is the profit globally. And I don't know what the answer is. But what I would say is that genetics is killed with farmers, and we heard this earlier as well. It's unlike a nutritional or a management strategy, the future has to be enforced every year. This can be built on year by year. So just to conclude, I think when we start talking about environmental consequences of animal production systems, we have to look at the production system in its entirety. We're already making actually good environmental gains, and we're not even thinking about measuring, or we haven't even measured environmental effects yet. And in many instances, we haven't even measured. I think academics, and I'm one of them myself, so I can see it. You get a bit carried away with all this sexy science and fancy lingo that we put out these traits, and why methane in chambers and the use of genomics. But I hope that convinced you that isn't really all that good, or in some cases can actually be detrimental if you don't have the basic goals from the start. And for prioritization purposes, just to reduce the environmental footprint, I would say get the basics right first, and then secondly get the intention out. Get farmers to use the